city. Young Roosevelt was not widely known. The boss picked me as the candidate with whom he would be most likely to win, Roosevelt later granted. I had at that time neither the reputation nor the ability to have won the nomination for myself. In selecting Roosevelt, a second-year law student at Columbia, the Irish boss recognized the allure of the Roosevelt name. Theodore's father, the late Theodore Roosevelt Sr., had been a highly respected philanthropist who had worked to improve the lives of poor children through his work with the Children's Aid Society, Miss Sattery's Night School for Little Italians, and the Newsboys Lodging House. Indeed, when the nomination of Theodore Roosevelt was announced, the New York Daily Tribune suggested that, in voting for the son of one of the most loved and respected figures in the history of New York, voters would have the opportunity to show their regard for an honored name. The boss also understood that Roosevelt had the means to contribute to his own campaign. So while Lincoln, as he conceded in his opening statement, had no wealthy or popular relations to recommend him, it was precisely those relations and that wealth that brought young Roosevelt to the attention of the Republican boss. Looking back, Roosevelt credited the element of chance, the demographics of the assembly district, and the power of his family name as the chief instrument behind his first opportunity. He also understood, however, that when an opportunity comes, a person has to take advantage of that opportunity. I put myself in the way of things happening, and they happened. Indeed, it was young Roosevelt himself who had taken the initiative to become a member of the local Republican Association, which held its meetings at Morton Hall, at the corner of 59th Street and 5th Avenue. Morton Hall was a large, smoke-filled room over a saloon with shabby benches, cuspidors, and poker tables. To join the party then was no simple thing, Roosevelt later recalled. The party was still treated as a private corporation, and in each district, the organization formed a kind of social and political club. A man had to be regularly proposed for and elected into this club, just as into any other club. When he began inquiring into the local Republican organization, he was warned by his privileged circle, men of cultivated taste and easy life, that district politics were low. The province of saloon keepers, horse car conductors and the like, men who would be rough and brutal and unpleasant to deal with. Their disdain did not dissuade Roosevelt, who turned their condescension on its head. I answered that if this were so, it merely meant that the people I knew did not belong to the governing class, and that the other people did, and that I intended to be one of the governing class, that if they proved too hard bit for me, I suppose I would have to quit, but that I certainly would not quit until I had made the effort and found out whether I really was too weak to hold my own in the rough and tumble. So once again, questions emerge. What attracted this abundantly privileged, sheltered young man to the alien and contemptible world of local politics? Where did his ambition come from? When Roosevelt sat down at the age of 53 to trace the narrative that led from this first run for office to the White House, he provided his own useful, albeit sometimes misleading, answers to some of these questions. In order to frame the discussion, he methodically distinguishes two types of success, whether in the arts, in battle, or in politics. The first success, he argues, belongs to the man who has in him the natural power to do what no one else can do, and what no amount of training, no perseverance, or willpower will enable an ordinary man to do. He cites the poet who could write Ode on a Grecian Urn, the president who could deliver the Gettysburg Address, and Lord Nelson at Trafalgar, as manifestations of genius, examples of men assigned extraordinary gifts at birth. The second and more common type of success, he maintains, is not dependent on such unique inborn attributes, but on a man's ability to develop ordinary qualities to an extraordinary degree through ambition and the application of hard, sustained work. Unlike genius, which can inspire but not educate, self-made success is democratic, open to the average man of sound body and fair mind, who has no remarkable mental or physical attributes, but who enlarges each of those attributes to the maximum degree. He suggests that it is more useful to study this second type, for with determination, anyone can, if he chooses, find out how to win a similar success himself. It is clear from the start of Roosevelt's story of his leadership journey that he unequivocally aligns himself with this second type of success. His story is the tale of a sickly boy with a timid temperament who, believing in the gospel of will, transforms his body and emboldens his spirit. Through great effort and discipline, his weak body becomes strong. Through visualization and practice, he confronts fear and becomes brave. I like to believe that by what I have accomplished without great gifts, I may be a source of encouragement to Americans. This picture of a young boy building his character brick by brick until he develops a moral concept of leadership based upon that character is simplistic and incomplete, yet remarkably, however, it contains large elements of truth. T.D. Roosevelt was indeed a nervous, unhealthy, fragile child whose boyhood was shaped by terrifying attacks of bronchial asthma. Generally stealing on him in the middle of the night, these attacks created the sensation of suffocating or drowning. Hearing his son coughing, wheezing, and struggling for breath, Theodore Sr., known as Thee, would rush into the bedroom. Taking his son into his arms, he would carry him around the house for hours until he could breathe and fall asleep. If this ritual proved inadequate, he would call for the servants to bring the horse and carriage round. Wrapping the gasping child in a blanket, he would drive the horse at a good clip through the gaslit streets, believing that the bracing night winds would stir the child's lungs. "Nobody seemed to think I would live," Roosevelt later recalled. "My father, he got me breath. He got me lungs, strength, life." While asthma weakened young Roosevelt's body, it indirectly spurred the development of an already precocious mind. From the very fact that he was not able originally to enter into the most vigorous activities, his younger sister Corinne noted, he was always reading or writing with a most unusual power of concentration. There was nothing ordinary about his intellectual vitality, his curiosity, or his ambitious dream life. Under the guiding eye of his father, who ceaselessly encouraged his son's intellectual and spiritual development, T.D. became a ferocious reader, transporting himself into the lives of the adventurous heroes he most admired, men with extraordinary bodily strength who were fearless in battle, explorers in Africa, deer slayers living on the edge of the wilderness. When asked years later whether he knew the characters in James Fenimore Cooper's Leatherstocking Tales, he laughed, "Do I know them? I have bunked with them and eaten with them, and I know their strengths and weaknesses." Few young children read as broadly or had such access to books as young Roosevelt. He had only to pick a volume from the shelves of the vast library in his family's home or express interest in a particular book, and it would magically materialize. During one family vacation, T.D. proudly reported that he and his younger brother and sister, Elliot and Corinne, had devoured 50 novels. Thee read aloud to his children in the evenings after dinner. He spiced learning with family games and competitions. He organized amateur plays for them, urged them to recite poetry, and encouraged each of them to follow their particular interests. Above all, he sought to impart didactic principles of duty, ethics, and morality through stories, fables, and maxims. "Leaders in every field," Roosevelt later wrote, "need more than anything else to know human nature, to know the needs of the human soul, and they will find this nature and these needs set forth as nowhere else by the great imaginative writers, whether of prose or of poetry." The effortless way T.D. secured hundreds of books provides stark contrast with the 6-mile trek of Abraham, to borrow Kirkham's English Grammar, a comparison made brutal by superimposing Thee's constant endeavors to feed T.D.'s reading with the image of Thomas Lincoln tearing books from Abraham's grasp. Yet however dissimilar their upbringings, books became for both Lincoln and Roosevelt the greatest of companions. Every day, for the rest of their lives, both men set aside time for reading, snatching moments while waiting for meals, between visitors, or lying in bed before sleep. Roosevelt's insistence that he had no great gifts is contradicted not only by his remarkable mental vitality, but also by his prodigious memory. When talking about books he had read years before, the pages would appear before him as if he were able to read anew with his mind's eye. In contrast to Lincoln's mind, which he himself likened to a piece of steel, hard to scratch anything on it, though almost impossible thereafter to rub it out, Roosevelt's mind, one friend observed, was wax to receive and marble to retain. It seemed as if he could remember everything he read, the friend marveled. He had only to read something once, and it was his to retrieve forever, allowing him to summon not only whole passages, but the feelings evoked in him when he first encountered them. Young Roosevelt, unlike Lincoln, did not identify himself early on as a leader, nor was he identified as such by those around him. T.D.'s precarious health kept him from public school and from natural relationships with boys his own age. He and his siblings, his older sister Bammy, younger sister Corinne, and younger brother Elliot, all suffered from a range of serious physical ailments, were taught the fundamentals of reading, writing, and arithmetic by tutors at home. Their only playmates were members of their extended family, all from the same patrician class. Within this small circle of children, however, T.D. occupied the center, organizing their play, directing their games, entertaining them with his talent for telling stories. Corinne treasured the episodic narratives her 8-year-old brother would spin, stories drawn from both his imagination and the books he had read. Storytelling played an integral role in the Roosevelt family life. T.D.'s mother, Martha Bullock, Mitty, an unreconstructed Southerner who had grown up in a stately mansion in Georgia, regaled her son with romantic, chivalric tales of life in the antebellum South. The precocious T.D., one biographer noted, displayed not only a purposeful, determined personality, but also an almost ruthless single-mindedness where his interests were concerned. By the age of 10, he had developed a passionate interest in nature and the ambition to become a famous ornithologist, like J.J. Audubon. As he roamed the woodland trails, surrounding his family's summer retreats, searching for freedom to clear his lungs, he began to observe birds, listening to their songs, discerning their various shapes and plumage. He collected bugs, insects, and reptiles, which he kept in his bureau drawers. Noting his son's absorption in birds and mammals, Fee bought him a collection of volumes on natural history and provided private taxidermy lessons with one of Audubon's assistants. The same aggressive focus T.D. had given to his reading, he now directed towards skinning, dissecting, and mounting hundreds of meticulously labeled specimens, which he assembled in what he proudly called the Roosevelt Museum of Natural History. Oblivious to the mess he created in the bedroom, fetid containers filled with dissected creatures stood in every corner. He drove Elliot to beg for a separate room. The uniquely extensive education Fee provided his children, so different from the intensive education Lincoln crafted for himself, stretched far beyond the boundaries of their winter and summer homes to include 2 separate year-long journeys abroad, the first to Europe, the second to the Middle East, the Holy Land, and Africa. They stayed in exclusive hotels and inns, in tents, and private homes. They spent 2 months in Rome, 3 weeks in Greece, 2 weeks in Lebanon, 3 weeks in Palestine, and an entire winter in Egypt. And all was at night. Fee, solicitous father, mentor, minister, and tour guide, would read aloud the poetry, history, and literature of the region they were visiting. In Dresden, they lived for 2 months with a German family. Fee had made arrangements to hire the host's daughter to immerse the children in the German language, literature, music, and art. T.D. was so intrigued with his lessons, which lasted 6 hours of the day, that he pleaded to extend them further. And of course, Elliot complained, I could not be left behind, so we are working harder than ever in our lives. While Abraham, gifted with physical agility and uncommon athletic prowess, had to make his mind, T.D., privileged beyond measure with resources to develop his mind, had to make his body. By the age of 10, his chronic asthma required more and more days of bed rest. Thee feared that his son was becoming too familiar with illness, timidity, and frailness, following in the footsteps of his mother, who had become increasingly fragile after the destruction of her family's Georgia home during the Civil War. Plagued by palpitations, intestinal pain, debilitating headaches, and depression, she regularly withdrew to her room. Worried that T.D., like Mitty, was becoming an invalid, Thee took his son aside. "Theodore, you have the mind, but not the body. And without the help of the body, the mind cannot go as far as it should. You must make your body. It is hard drudgery to make one's body, but I know you will do it." T.D. responded enthusiastically, promising his father, "I'll make my body." With the help of his father, who hired the owner of a nearby gym to build a fully equipped gymnasium on the back porch, T.D. lifted weights and hoisted himself on horizontal bars, slowly, ever so slowly, expanding his physical capabilities and refashioning his body. That his bodily self-esteem remained vulnerable was apparent the following summer, when he encountered two bullies while traveling alone on a stagecoach to Moosehead Lake in the north woods of Maine. "They found that I was a foreordained and predestined victim," he remembered years later, "and industriously proceeded to make life miserable for me." Finding he was unable to fight back, he resolved that he would not again be put in such a helpless position. When he told his father he wanted to learn how to box, Thee hired the services of an ex-prize fighter to train his son. Even when T.D. began studying for Harvard's entrance examinations, he continued his rigorous exercise regime. "The young man never seemed to know what idleness was," observed Arthur Cutler, a recent Harvard graduate who had been hired to prepare T.D. for the exams. "Every leisure moment would find the last novel, some English classic, or some abstruse book on natural history in his hands." Working long hours every day, T.D. studied Latin, Greek, literature, history, science, and mathematics, completing in 2 years what normally took 3 years of preparation. His ability to concentrate, one contemporary recalled, was such that the house might fall about his head and he would not be diverted. When given an assignment, he rarely waited until the last moment. He regarded procrastination as a sin. Preparing ahead, he recognized freedom from anxiety, a habit of mind that would set an example for his colleagues in the years ahead. Easily passing all 8 examinations, he was admitted to Harvard, eager to leave his mark on the world, though not knowing exactly how. The story of Theodore Roosevelt, one biographer has suggested, is the story of a small boy who read about great men and decided he wanted to be like them. There is a decided accuracy to this statement, but more than the fictional characters he admired, young Roosevelt found in his own father the most powerful exemplar of the heroic ideal. "My father was the best man I ever knew," Roosevelt later said. "He combined strength and courage with gentleness, tenderness, and great unselfishness. He was a public figure of great accomplishment in the philanthropic world, committed to every social reform movement, yet I never knew anyone who got greater joy out of living than did my father." Roosevelt considered Thee not only his best and most intimate friend, but a beloved mentor, whose advice he heeded above all others. "It seems perfectly wonderful in looking back over my 18 years of existence," he told his family, "to see how I have literally never spent an unhappy day, unless by my own fault." While more than intellectually prepared for his studies at Harvard, Theodore lacked the social skills of many of his fellow students. One classmate remembers him as studious, ambitious, eccentric, not the sort to appeal at first. The shelves in his room were filled with dead lizards and stuffed birds. If academic nonchalance was in style, Theodore was strident and zealous, prone to interrupt class in order to barrage professors with objections and questions. He disdained fellow students who drank or smoked, and kept his distance from classmates until he could determine if their families shared his own station in life. If young Roosevelt lacked the empathy and kindness that won Lincoln affection wherever he went, his original personality eventually captivated his classmates, who marveled at his irrepressible energy and lack of self-consciousness. Though he never conquered asthma completely, suffering spasms at irregular intervals for decades, he had strengthened his body sufficiently so that he could participate in a wide array of sports. He wrestled and sparred, ran 3 or 4 miles a day, took up rowing and tennis, and continued to work out in the gym. Though he failed to excel in any of these activities, he derived immense satisfaction from the sheer fact of overcoming his earlier invalidism. While posting honor grades every semester, he organized a whist club and a finance club, joined the rifle club and the arts club, and he was elected to the most prestigious social club of all, the Porcellian. Nor did he abandon his interest in birds, tramping miles from Cambridge to observe them, shoot them, and stuff them. In the midst of all this activity, he managed to teach Sunday school and take weekly dance classes. Of course, he danced awkwardly, just as you'd expect him to dance, a classmate recalled. He hopped. His life at Harvard broadened every interest, Corinne noted, and did for him what had hitherto not been done, which was to give him confidence in his relationship with young men of his own age. Theodore would need all the confidence he had developed at Harvard to withstand the single greatest sorrow he could possibly have imagined. In December of Theodore's sophomore year, his 46-year-old father fell ill with colon cancer. Earlier that fall, Fee had been nominated by President Rutherford B. Hayes to be Collector of Customs for the Port of New York, the most powerful federal post beyond the cabinet. Fee's nomination, which had to be approved by the Senate, was considered a triumph for civil service reformers and a blow to the corrupt politicians who, over the years, had treated the post as a private treasure chest. For weeks, the Senate was consumed by a battle between the reform element of the Republican Party and the machine politicians. The machine element won. Fee's nomination was turned down. "I fear for your future," Fee wrote his son. "We cannot stand so corrupt a government for any length of time." A warning that would long reverberate in young Roosevelt's mind, helping to shape his embattled style of leadership. Fee's death, 3 months after his diagnosis, brought Theodore unbearable sorrow. "I felt as if I had been stunned, or as if part of my life had been taken away," he recorded in his diary. "If it were not for the certainty that, as he himself has so often said, he is not dead, but gone before, I should almost perish." In the days that followed, Theodore filled his diary with thoughts of his father. "Every now and then, it seems to me like a hideous dream," he wrote. "Sometimes, when I fully realize my loss, I feel as if I should go wild, for he was everything to me. My father, companion, friend." "The death of Mr. Roosevelt was a public loss," stated the New York Times. "Flags flew at half-mast all over the city. Rich and poor followed him to the grave." As Theodore contemplated his father's legacy, he began to take the measure of his own life. "Oh, how little worthy I am of such a father," he wrote in his diary. "How I wish I could ever do something to keep up his name." For Theodore, who had been blessed with a positive temperament, it was only a matter of time before he recovered his spirits. In late June, he confided in his diary the surprising recognition that he was leading the most intensely happy and healthy out-of-doors life, spending his days riding on horseback, making long tramps through the woods and fields after specimens. In frenetic movement, he found relief, as well as an understanding of his fundamental character. "I could not be happier, except at those bitter moments when I realize what I have lost. Father was so invariably cheerful that I feel it would be wrong for me to be gloomy, and besides, fortunately or unfortunately, I am of a very buoyant temper, being a bit of an optimist. No one but my wife, if ever I marry, Theodore wrote in his diary, will ever be able to take my father's place. The following fall, his junior year at Harvard, he fell in love with Alice Hathaway Lee, the 17-year-old daughter of a wealthy Brahmin family in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. It was a real case of love at first sight, Theodore told a friend, and my first love, too. With the same single-mindedness he had given to his books, his specimen collections, and the building up of his body, he launched a crusade to make Alice his wife. He escorted her to parties and to dances, took her skating and sledding, on horseback rides over trails, and long hikes through the woods. He introduced her to his friends at Harvard and brought her to meet his mother and siblings in New York. He laid siege to her family, playing whist with her parents, entertaining her younger brothers with ghost stories and tales of adventure. He made everything subordinate to winning her. He asked her to marry him 6 months after they met. She turned him down, fearful of taking such a big step at such a young age. Her rejection made him nearly crazy, unable to study or sleep at night. He refused to give up, however, and 8 months later, after much pleading, she finally consented to be his wife. "I am so happy that I dare not trust my own happiness," he recorded the night she accepted. "I do not believe any man loved a woman more than I love her," he rejoiced 2 months later. Privilege can stunt ambition, just as the lack of privilege can fire ambition. Privilege had not hampered the fierce drive that led Theodore to master every activity, from his voracious reading to the creation of the Roosevelt Museum of Natural History, from the rigorous workout regimen he maintained to the intense concentration that produced excellence at every stage of his education. Yet under the sheltering wing of his father, privilege had allowed him to indulge his wide-ranging interests without the need of practical focus. Thee was the one who had provided his son with his own library, a private gym, a personal trainer, tutors in taxidermy and college preparation, and the means to collect specimens from around the world to fill his personal museum. During his freshman year at Harvard, his father had told him that if he were still committed to becoming a naturalist, he could do so. He explained that he had made enough money to allow me to take up such a career and do non-remunerative work of value if I intended to do the very best work there was in me, but that I must not dream of taking it up as a dilettante. That Theodore Roosevelt did not become a naturalist, he attributed to the curriculum at Harvard, where biology was treated as purely a science of the laboratory and the microscope, ignoring the study of birds, animals, trees, and the outdoor world. For a young man who craved continual motion, who had methodically increased his physical endurance and strength over the years, the idea of a sedentary career, studying tissues under a microscope, held no allure. Theodore's recognition that he was not suited for science revealed a growing self-awareness, a deepening understanding of his own temperamental strengths and weaknesses that would become an essential tool in his leadership arsenal. Though he abandoned the prospects of a naturalist career, he never stopped pursuing outdoor adventures or his passion for the natural world. In the 18 months after his father's death, he went on 3 expeditions into the deep wilderness regions of Maine, each sojourn further stretching the horizons of his cramped social world and bringing him in close quarters with people whose lives he had encountered only through books. The first trip had been arranged through his Harvard tutor. "I want you to take that young fellow under your special care," Cutler told the Maine guide, Bill Sewell. "He is not very strong, and he's got a great deal of ambition and grit. Even if he was tired, he would not tell you so. The first thing you knew, he would be down, because he would go until he fell." Cutler's assessment proved on the mark. While Theodore suffered from a serious asthma attack during the trip, he never once lost his good nature or seemed out of sorts, whether canoeing 5 miles on the river tramping 35 miles in the forest, helping to pitch the tents, or missing numerous shots at loons, ducks, and pigeons. The 34-year-old Maine guide, who had become Roosevelt's mentor and lifelong friend, was the first to see in the young man the makings of a leader. "He was different from anybody I ever met," Sewell said. "Wherever he went, he got right in with people, connecting with them, talking with them, enjoying them without the slightest trace of condescension." The boy who had begun college leery of commingling with lower social echelons now bunked in a lumber camp with a large crew of woodsmen who did not know anything but the woods. "I doubt if they could have written their names," Sewell recalled, "but they knew the woods, the whole of them, and they knew all the hardships connected with pioneer life." That young Roosevelt could open himself up to such men, relate to them, and learn from them, suggested that in the aftermath of great sorrow, he was beginning to chip away at the inherited elitism of his privileged background. He told Sewell he was thrilled to get first-hand accounts of backwoods life from the men who had lived it and knew what they were talking about. Even at this early age, Sewell marveled, he was quick to find the real man in very simple men. He listened intently to their stories. He told stories himself from the adventure books he had read. He connected with them. He was learning, Sewell said, what it meant to be an American. The idea that no man is superior unless it was by merit, and no man is inferior unless by his demerit. The profound pleasure Theodore had discovered in a different kind of social life would lead to a reassessment of his future prospects. He had thought for a time to follow his father's footsteps, carrying on the philanthropic work Thee had so successfully undertaken to improve the lot of the poor. "I tried faithfully to do what my father had done," he told a friend, "but I did it poorly." After joining this and that committee and assuming several board positions formerly held by his father, he found the work uncongenial. He could no more sit in meetings for hours on end than he could sit in a laboratory staring into a microscope. He concluded that he had to work in his own way to carry forward the moral ardor his father had displayed. The noblesse oblige he had inherited from his privileged class felt too removed from the action of life, too indirect. Moreover, he began to suspect that charitable work would be less necessary if the political order provided remedies for the underlying social conditions. "I'm going to try to help the cause of better government in New York City," he told a friend during his senior year in college. "I don't know exactly how." He decided to go to Columbia Law School, not because he wanted to be a lawyer, but because he considered it a first step toward involvement in some aspect of public life. He found the courses at law school ill-suited to his temperament, noting critically that the professors were more concerned with what law is, not what it ought to be, emphasizing legal precedents rather than justice. In college, he had deliberately stayed away from debating societies, believing it wrong to train young men to talk glibly on any given side of a proposition, regardless of their convictions or moral principles. He worried that as a lawyer he would be required to do precisely that. He wanted to win arguments because they were right, not because he had skillfully marshaled an array of one-sided facts. His energies not fully engaged in his classes, he began spending more and more time at Morton Hall, immersed in the blood sport of working-class politics. "When I went into politics," Roosevelt later conceded, "I was not conscious of going in with the purpose to benefit other people, but of getting for myself a privilege to which I was entitled in common with other people." Unlike Lincoln, who held a double ambition from the start, not solely for himself, but also for the people he wanted to lead, 23-year-old Roosevelt intended simply to exercise his right of citizenship with small consideration toward embarking upon a career. Deploring the lack of interest in the political questions of the day among respectable, well-educated men, young men especially, he sought to set an example. "Who's the greenhorn?" the people of New Salem had asked upon first encountering the awkward, poorly dressed, ill-educated Lincoln. "Who's the dude?" the local politicians inquired upon first seeing young Roosevelt. With his hair parted in the center, short whiskers on his cheeks, a monocle over one eye held in place by a gold chain over his ear, a waistcoat and trousers, as tight as a tailor could make them, he looked the embodiment of a dandy, overly concerned with appearance and manners. Yet for Theodore and young Abraham, once the oddity of first impressions faded, perspectives shifted, and people strongly connected with both of them. Week after week, Theodore visited Morton Hall, relaxing with working-class Irish and German immigrants, with butchers, carpenters, and grooms as they drank beer and smoked cigars, listening to their stories, joining them in games of cards, thoroughly enjoying the convivial masculine atmosphere. "I went around often enough to have the men get accustomed to me, and have me get accustomed to them," he later said, "so that we began to speak the same language, and so that each could begin to live down in the other's mind what Bret Harte has called the defective quality of being a stranger." In time, the men at Morton Hall recognized they were in the presence of an exceptionally good-natured, earnest, appealing, intelligent young man who fought for what he believed, but accepted defeat with good humor. Watching Roosevelt over a period of months, local boss Joe Murray began to take a paternal interest in him, and finally concluded that this 23-year-old son of privilege could make a credible run for the state legislature. The time between the November 1st nomination and the election occupied but a single week, magnifying the vital role of the party organizations in bringing out the vote. To open the campaign, the boss planned to take Roosevelt on a personal canvass through the saloons along 6th Avenue. Saloon keepers in those days played an instrumental political role, drawing up checklists of the right voters in the ward, making sure those voters got to the polls. The first stop was Valentine Young's bar. No sooner had Roosevelt been introduced to Mr. Young than trouble began. The saloon keeper told Roosevelt that if he won, he expected him to vote for lowering the cost of the liquor licenses, which were much too high. Roosevelt replied that while he would treat all interests fairly, on the contrary, liquor taxes were not high enough, and that he would vote to raise them. The boss swiftly shepherded Roosevelt away, deciding that he and his colleagues would henceforth take care of the 6th Avenue vote, leaving Roosevelt to solicit votes among his neighbors and friends. In the few statements he made, Roosevelt proclaimed that he was owned by no man and would enter the legislature untrammeled and unpledged. With no sense of irony, he proclaimed that, despite his friendship with and key obligations to Joe Murray, he would obey no boss and serve no clique. His pledge of independence struck a chord with the residents of the Silk Stocking District, who detested machine politics and rarely bothered to get involved in local elections. The strategy of running as an independent widened Roosevelt's appeal. 2 days after the nomination, a list of 20 prominent New Yorkers, including future Secretary of State Elihu Root and Columbia Law Professor Theodore Dwight, published a vigorous endorsement of young Roosevelt's candidacy. "We take much pleasure in testifying to our appreciation of his high character," the manifesto declared. "He is conspicuous for his honesty and integrity." That same day, Joseph Choate, the future ambassador to Great Britain, organized a circle of Thee's friends to contribute to Republican campaign coffers. "Men worth millions solicited the votes of their coachmen," journalist Jacob Rees reported, "and were glad to get them." On election day, the Brownstone vote came out in much larger numbers than usual. Roosevelt won the assembly seat with a margin almost twice the size of the typical Republican vote. "My first days in the legislature were much like those of a boy in a strange school," Roosevelt recalled. "My fellow legislators and I eyed one another with mutual distrust." Not only was Roosevelt the youngest member, but the Democrats held a commanding majority, and he was a Republican from the wealthiest district in New York. While Lincoln kept quietly in the background throughout his first session, watching and figuring, Roosevelt charged into action, often irritating his colleagues, violating the rules of parliamentary procedure. With abrasive and manic energy, he interrogated his fellow assemblymen, aggressively soaking up everything they knew about how the assembly operated. "How do you do this in your district and county?" he would ask. "What is this thing and that thing?" Within a short period of time, he knew more about state politics than 90% of the veteran members did. In short order, he had divided the members into three groups. A small circle of fellow reformers, those he labeled very good men. Another circle of very bad men, beholden to Tammany Hall, New York's political machine, and susceptible to bribery. And a majority, neither very good nor very bad, who could be swayed in either direction, depending on the strength of public opinion. After scarcely 2 months in office, he seized the spotlight, displaying what would become a characteristic penchant for brash maneuvering. Newspaper reports had accused State Judge Theodore Westbrook of using court proceedings to help the Wall Street financier Jay Gould gain control of New York's elevated railway system. After investigating the matter further, Roosevelt was convinced that Westbrook had forged a corrupt alliance with the notorious robber baron. Rising from his seat, the rookie assemblyman delivered a fiery indictment of the judge that produced banner headlines, making Theodore Roosevelt the most talked-about man in the state. In an era of subserviency to the robber barons of the street, the New York Times editorialized, it needs some little courage in any public man to characterize them and their acts in fitting terms. At this introductory stage of his career, Roosevelt viewed politics in a puritanical light, as an arena where good battled evil. He had seen his father's dreams of high office undone by corruption. He had absorbed his father's warning that the country could not much longer stand so corrupt a government. He was a knight embarked on a crusade to uncover corruption at the highest levels, jousting against the black horse cavalry of machine politicians. "There is nothing brilliant or outstanding about my record, except perhaps for one thing," he told a reporter. "When I make up my mind to do a thing, I act." Even as his political star was beginning to rise, Roosevelt insisted that politics was not a proper occupation. As a citizen, one might intermittently engage in political activity, but it would be a dreadful misfortune for a man to grow to feel that his whole livelihood and whole happiness depend upon his staying in office. Such a feeling prevents him from being of real service to the people while in office, and always puts him under the heaviest strain to barter his convictions for the sake of holding office. Yet it was already clear after this first year in the assembly that Theodore Roosevelt had found his calling. Politics encompassed the activities he found most enjoyable and fulfilling: speaking, writing, connecting with people, assuming center stage. A fuse had been lit that would keep him in politics and public life for the rest of his days. "I rose like a rocket," Theodore Roosevelt recalled of his ascent. Notwithstanding a statewide Democratic sweep, he had gained a second term, and despite his youth, he had been chosen by his Republican colleagues as their minority leader. But as his friend Jacob Riis shrewdly warned, if they do shoot up like a rocket, they are apt to come down like sticks. In the wake of these triumphs, Roosevelt lost perspective. His head was swelled. He became indulgent and self-absorbed. He began to think that he alone had cornered the market on honesty and integrity. "There is an increasing suspicion," one observer noted, "that Mr. Roosevelt keeps a pulpit concealed on his person." The small circle of reformers who had idolized him at the start watched with growing concern as he became a perfect nuisance, constantly interrupting assembly business, yelling and pounding his desk with his fist. "He was just like a jack coming out of a box," one member recalled. When criticized by Democrats, he fired back venomously, castigating the entire party as rotten His friends pleaded with him to sit on his coattails, warning that he was ruining himself and everybody else with his explosive and indiscreet attacks. But he would listen to no argument, no advice, self-infatuated as he reveled in the headlines his colorful language generated. After failing to mobilize support for several projects, however, he realized that he was absolutely deserted, even by his friends. My isolated peak had become a valley. Every bit of influence I had was gone. The things I wanted to do, I was powerless to accomplish. The bitter experience was a blow to his ego, to the dogmatic and self-righteous aspect of his nature that prevented him from working with others and learning to compromise. He began to see, he conceded, that he was not all important and that cooperation from other people was essential, even if they were not so pure as gold. And he learned that if he could not get all he wanted, he would take all he could. He turned to help others, and they, in turn, gave him a hand. The world was far more complicated and nuanced than his categorical moral vision had led him to believe. The ability to learn from the excesses of his egocentric behavior, to alter course, to profit from error, was essential to his growth. Roosevelt further revealed that capacity for growth when a union-sponsored bill to prohibit the manufacture of cigars in tenement houses was referred to one of the committees on which he sat. When the bill was first introduced, he presumed he would vote against it, as he had voted against minimum wage legislation and bills to limit the hours of the working day. Both his membership in the privileged class and the laissez-faire economics he had learned in college had biased him, he later said, against all governmental schemes for the betterment of the social and economic condition of laborers. In the case of the cigar bill, he believed the tenement owners, who were also the manufacturers, had a right to do as they wished with their own property. After meeting with the labor leader Samuel Gompertz and hearing his description of the dreadful conditions in the tenement apartments where thousands of families lived and worked, stripping, drying, and wrapping cigars, he agreed to make a personal inspection. Roosevelt was so stunned by what he found that he made a turnabout and agreed to become the bill's champion. 30 years later, he would still remember one noxious tenement in which 5 adults and several children, all Bohemian immigrants who could barely speak English, were enclosed in a single room, compelled to work 16 hours a day, with tobacco crammed in every corner next to the bedding, mixed in with the food. The investigation persuaded him, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that to permit the manufacturer of cigars in tenement houses was an evil thing from every standpoint, social, industrial, and hygienic. The incident suggests Roosevelt's developing sense of empathy. While Lincoln's seems to have been his by right of birth, Roosevelt slowly expanded his understanding of other people's points of view by going to places that a man of his background typically neither visited nor comprehended. The real things of life were getting a grip on him, more and more, Jacob Riis observed. In an essay on Fellow Feeling, written a decade and a half later, Roosevelt maintained that empathy, like courage, could be acquired over time. A man who conscientiously endeavors to throw in his lot with those about him, to make his interest theirs, to put himself in a position where he and they have a common object, will at first feel a little self-conscious, will realize too plainly his aims. But with exercise, this will pass off. He will speedily find that the fellow feeling which at first he had to stimulate was really existent, though latent, and is capable of a very healthy growth. Indeed, he argued that a very large part of the rancor of political and social strife springs from the fact that different classes, or sections, are so cut off from each other that neither appreciates the other's passions, prejudices, and indeed, point of view. By his 3rd term in the Assembly, Roosevelt had begun to soften his abrasive self-righteousness. Working with Democrats, whom he had previously labeled as rotten. He brought the two parties together to pass civil service reform and a host of bills to benefit the city of New York. He had taken his weaknesses, his physical liabilities, his fears, and the brash and self-centered aspects of his leadership style, and had carefully worked to overcome them. At 25 years old, happily married and awaiting the birth of his first child, he now felt, he told his wife, that he had the reins in his own hands.
Chapter 3. Franklin. No, call me Franklin. No fixed timetable governs the development of leaders. While Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, and Franklin Roosevelt all possessed inherent leadership capacities, the period of time when they first perceived themselves as leaders and were considered leaders by others occurred at different stages of their growth. Hardship quickened Abraham Lincoln's self-reliance. Early on, he revealed a number of traits associated with leadership: ambition, motivation, resoluteness, language skills, storytelling gifts, sociability. The people who knew him from boyhood to young manhood saw the makings of a leader, just as he was beginning to feel that same potential within himself. Theodore Roosevelt came later to the sense of himself as a leader, though others had clearly seen flashes of a unique nature, a remarkable willpower, intellectual vitality, irrepressible liveliness, wide-ranging interests, and a growing gratification connecting with people from different backgrounds and stations in life. Franklin Roosevelt, reared without siblings at Springwood, a country estate on the banks of the Hudson, was the latest bloomer of the three. The fierce ambition to succeed, so apparent in young Abraham and Theodore, was largely concealed, just as he concealed so much else in his life. There was little evidence of exceptional motivation or focus. Though he was the most conventionally handsome of the three, he lacked the physical strength and competitive athletic skill that lent young Abraham standing among his male companions. Nor did he seem to possess the torrential energy that amused and overwhelmed everyone who met young Theodore. An indifferent student at Groton, Harvard College, and Columbia Law, Franklin ostensibly was following an expected path for a member of the privileged class by joining an old conservative Wall Street law firm. At the age of 28, when both Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt had already evidenced striking leadership attributes, Franklin had not impressed the partners of his law firm with either his native intelligence, his work ethic, or his sense of purpose. Yet, when fortune shone on him in the form of a wholly unexpected offer from the top Dutchess County Democratic bosses, John Mack and Edward Perkins, to run for a safe Democratic seat in the state assembly with the full backing of the party, Franklin hastened to accept, revealing a great eagerness to jump into politics. He knew something about himself that others did not, that beneath his complacent demeanor, he craved adventure, a desire for freedom from the confines of his insulated world. In all likelihood, he felt the promptings of ambition within himself long before others detected it. Some impulse told him that the political world might provide the best fit for his gregarious temperament, natural abilities, and undeveloped talents. It is not clear whether John Mack had ever met Franklin before the late spring day in 1910 when he called upon the young law clerk at Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn. As a pretext for the visit, Mack carried some documents that required the signature of Franklin's mother, Sarah. After concluding the business part of the meeting, Mack turned to the real reason for dropping by, to sound out Franklin on the possibility of running for an assembly seat from the district that included Poughkeepsie and Hyde Park, the village where Roosevelt had grown up and where his mother still lived. Mack explained that the incumbent Democratic assemblyman, Louis Stuyvesant Chandler, had decided to retire. For generations, Democrats had held the seat, based largely on the Irish and Italian vote in Poughkeepsie. But the party hoped to reach out as well to the traditionally rural Republican areas within the district, and Mac thought Franklin might be the right person for the job. That Mac and Perkins considered Franklin the best choice had little to do with their perception that the young law clerk had within him the makings of a leader. The key to their interest lay in the resonance of the Roosevelt name in Republican circles. In 1910, after serving nearly two terms in the presidency, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin's fifth cousin, remained the most dominant figure on the national scene. Mac also understood that Sarah Roosevelt's wealth would allow her son not only to pay his own campaign expenses, but to contribute to the general Democratic coffers. So while Abraham Lincoln took the initiative on his own to run for his first elective office, and Theodore put himself in a position to gain the nomination by mingling with politicians at Morton Hall, Franklin Roosevelt was simply chosen to run. What proved more compelling than why Franklin was chosen was the manner in which he responded to the proffered opportunity. "Nothing would please me more," he enthusiastically replied. "Just tell me what to do, where to go, whom to seek out." What to do? Mac told him to spend time in the district, make the acquaintance of local Democratic activists. Franklin said he would start at once. He would spend as many summer weekends as he could in Hyde Park and Poughkeepsie, leaving his Wall Street firm on Friday afternoons, returning on Monday mornings. Whom to seek out? He should start with a Democratic committeeman from his home village, Tom Leonard. Consequently, at 3 o'clock one August afternoon, he searched out Leonard, a house painter currently at work inside one of the houses on the Roosevelt's country estate. The estate resembled an English country manor, with class lines separating the close little family of three at the top from the nurses and governesses, and these in turn from the maids and cooks indoors, and these in turn from the stable boys and farmhands outside. As a child, Franklin, seated on his pony, had ridden with his father every morning to survey the plantings and various construction projects underway on the estate. As they rode by, employees tipped their hats. Never having been formally introduced to the house painter, Roosevelt rang the bell. "There's a Mr. Franklin wants to see you," the housekeeper told Leonard. "I thought for a moment," Leonard said. But after searching his memory, he concluded, "I don't know any Mr. Franklin." Nonetheless, he stepped out to meet the gentleman, surprised to find none other than Mr. Franklin Roosevelt. "Hello, Tom," said the young patrician, smiling warmly and extending his hand in greeting. "How do you do, Mr. Roosevelt?" asked the puzzled painter. "No, call me Franklin. I'm going to call you Tom," he declared, telling him that he had come to ask his advice about getting into politics. That Roosevelt was able to extend his hand and seek counsel with such good-natured spirits and without a trace of affectation or pomposity won over Tom Leonard as it would soon win over thousands in Dutchess County. His manner, his affability, and his sincerity conveyed something authentic. With this first foray into politics, he had bridged, emblematically at least, a lifetime of social distance. Everywhere he went, people were immediately struck by young Franklin's warmth and charm. He made arrangements for a driver with a horse and two-wheeled wagon to meet him at the Hyde Park train station on Friday evenings. On Saturdays and Sundays, he traversed the district, attending political meetings, talking with people in general stores, stopping in village squares, standing outside manufacturing plants shaking hands. He made a good impression, Tom Leonard recalled, because he wouldn't immediately enter into the topic of politics. Instead, he encouraged people to talk about their work, their families, their lives. He had always loved to talk, But now he learned to listen, and to listen intently, his head nodding in a welcoming way with an air of sympathetic identification, an attentive posture and manner that would become a lifelong characteristic. With the assurance from the bosses that he would be nominated for the assembly seat at the convention, scheduled for early October, Franklin delivered his maiden political speech at the annual Policeman's Clambake on September 10th. "On that joyous occasion of clams and sauerkraut and real beer," Roosevelt later recalled, "I made my first political speech, and I've been apologizing for it ever since." Introduced by John Mack, Franklin began with a favorite phrase of Theodore Roosevelt's. "I'm delighted to be here," he said, summoning with phrases, gestures, and pince-nez glasses an identification with his famous relative. "And next year promise to be here again with all my relatives." No further record of the speech exists, though people who heard him speak in the weeks ahead remarked on his relaxed, conversational style. He mingled easily with crowds, pumped hands with enthusiasm, made friends everywhere he went. To the surprise of John Mack and other veteran office holders, it was beginning to seem unaccountably that this 28-year-old son of privilege, upon diving into the water for the first time, could swim like a seal. How, one wonders, was this possible? Temperament, Richard Neustadt argues in his classic study of presidential leadership, is the great separator. 4 days after Franklin Roosevelt took the presidential oath on March 4, 1933, he paid a call on former Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was celebrating his 92nd birthday. After Roosevelt left, Holmes famously opined, "A second-class intellect, but a first-class temperament." Generations of historians have agreed with Holmes, pointing to Roosevelt's self-assured, congenial, optimistic temperament as the keystone to his leadership success. If temperament is the key, the answers to our questions take us back to Springwood, the rural estate in Hyde Park where the very bedrock of Franklin Roosevelt's temperament was formed. "All that is in me goes back to the Hudson," Roosevelt liked to say, meaning not simply the tranquil river and the big country house, but the atmosphere of love and affection that enveloped him as a child. The boy's personality flourished in the warmth of his environment. Those who knew him as a child invariably used the same adjectives to describe him. A very nice child. Bright and happy. Radiant, beautiful, uncommonly poised. For his first 8 years, Franklin enjoyed a childhood of extraordinary stability and balance. From all accounts, James and Sarah Roosevelt had a genuine love marriage, despite the difference in their ages. James, courtly, well-educated, and gentle, was 52 when Franklin was born. Sarah, beautiful, strong-willed, and confident, was but half his age. The Roosevelt money had been made years before in real estate and the sugar trade, allowing Mr. James, as he was known, to lead the life of a country gentleman, adopting the habits and hobbies that imitated the English landed gentry. Franklin's still vigorous father introduced him to the masculine outside world, while his mother supervised the inside world of books, hobbies, and governesses. "Never," Sarah claimed, "did Franklin observe conflict between his parents regarding his upbringing, for at all times they presented a united front in dealing with him." With but a single child, Sarah suggested, the problem of juvenile squabbles virtually dispensed with itself. Franklin alone was the focus of his parents' lives, their joint vocation, heir, and hub of the place that was both a landed estate and a state of mind. A place from which all unpleasantness and discord seemed banished. In casting back through her thoroughly idealizing light upon Franklin's upbringing, Sarah failed to appreciate as her great-grandson John Boddicker Jr. later observed, that painkilling can itself be a lethal act. Children are strengthened through sibling relationships. They learn to play, bicker, fight, and play again, to accept criticism and bounce back from hurt, to tell secrets and become intimate. If there remained in Franklin Roosevelt throughout his life, Boddicker Jr. continued, an insensitivity towards and discomfort with profound and vividly expressed feelings, it may have been in part the lengthened shadow of his early sheltering from ugliness and jealousy and conflicting interests. Yet when Franklin was young, the impression that he was the center of the world produced a remarkable and lingering sense of security and privilege. For the rest of his life, Roosevelt remembered the peacefulness and regularity of his childhood days with great affection. Each passing season brought its unique cluster of outdoor activities. In winter, father and son went sledding and tobogganing down the steep hill that stretched from the south porch of the estate to the wooded bluffs of the river far below, maneuvering every curve with perfect ease. "We coasted," Franklin needled his mother. "Nothing dangerous, yet look out for tomorrow." With his father by his side, Franklin learned to ice skate and ice boat on the frozen Hudson. Then, with the first signs of spring, Franklin rode with his father each morning to survey the various constructions underway on the estate. He graduated from a donkey when he was 2 to a pony at 6 and a horse at 8. "Went fishing yesterday afternoon with Papa. We caught a dozen of minnows," Franklin enthusiastically wrote his mother when he was only 6. Beyond lessons on how to fish, Mr. James taught his son how to observe birds and identify trees and plants in the woods, fostering a lifelong love of nature. In summers, the family went to the island of Campobello, off far down east Maine, where Franklin learned to sail on Passamaquoddy Bay and to navigate the massive tides of the Bay of Fundy. In the fall, father and son went hunting together. With few playmates his own age, Franklin viewed his indulgent and protective father as a companion and friend. While James nourished Franklin's love of the outdoors, Sarah organized a carefully scheduled indoor regimen of regular mealtimes and specified hours for study and hobbies. Once, when Sarah saw her 5-year-old son uncharacteristically melancholy, she asked him why he was sad. He refused to answer at first, so she repeated.